Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here. And indeed, I'm a bit of a newcomer to Cambridge myself, so it's a great welcome to be able to, a great pleasure to be able to welcome you in such capacity. I'm going to talk to you today about stem cells from a perspective of my own personal interest and hope to interest you in it. If it isn't what you'd hoped to hear, that is to say how stem cells are going to cure everything that we currently suffer from, then please raise that question in the discussion period, which I hope will amount to about half of the whole hour. Because I'll just talk about a fairly limited perspective of what stem cells tell us about early mammalian development, in particular early human development. And that's, as I say, a personal interest, an enduring personal interest. And so let's get started. So first of all, I think we have to address the question of what are stem cells, and in order to determine what aspect of this set of questions we really can talk about. Now, obviously, there are many different perspectives about ourselves, about where our selfness comes from. Obviously, it has cosmic origins, because actually everything that we're composed of originated in supernova and stars, probably ones that predated our current solar system. But I'm not going to talk about that, despite this first slide that I used. We could talk about our evolutionary origins. And it would be important to do that because of this being the anniversary of Darwin. And I'm sure many of you have come to the university, back to Cambridge this year, to hear talks about Darwin and Darwin's life and Darwin's writings. But I'm not going to talk about that. We could talk about genetic origins, which is to say how we got the genome that makes us up, which is both an evolutionary and also a personal history question, who were our parents and who were our grandparents. But I'm not going to talk about that either. We can talk about psychological origins, which is to say how you got to be thinking about yourself as a separate entity. That's something that's probably uniquely in the great apes and perhaps even among humans, a unique capability that we actually can look in a mirror and see ourselves rather than some other object. And I think it's very interesting that we have the capability in our brains, that we have a mind, a concept of mind about self and other. But I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to talk about is how we got to be as a being. That is to say, how we got here with a body that contains our mind and our genes and our psychological concept. In other words, how we got to be a physical being, how we got to be a self. So how do stem cells relate to that? Well, I think it's important to say what stem cells are, that stem cells are a very special type of cell that is capable of self-renewal, by which we mean it's capable of reproducing itself, but it's also capable of differentiation. That is, it's a special cell that can undergo specialization and can produce another type of cell, a differentiated or more specialized cell. So how it does that is it does it through cell division. That is to say, a single cell, defined here as a stem cell, undergoes division, and it recreates itself in that process, but it also generates a specialized cell. And that's essentially the definition of a stem cell. So when this process of individuation finishes, we have, again, a stem cell, and I hope I haven't lost the laser, yes. We have a stem cell, which still has the original capacity of renewing itself and producing a differentiated cell, but we also have a specialized cell, which does not have the capacity of reproducing a stem cell. It can only reproduce specialized cells. Now, there are some nuances to that definition, but basically that's it. And, in fact, there are many different kinds of stem cells in our bodies. Probably, to us, those are the most important cells, because without our body's stem cells, we wouldn't survive very long, about 2 weeks, in fact. So the first thing you lose is your blood. The blood cells renew themselves in literally millions per second in your body, and that goes on throughout our life. The next thing you would lose would be your intestine, your gut, because those cells replace themselves, in effect, on a daily basis. So there are other cells, cell types of the body, the liver, for example, which are capable of renewing themselves through their own stem cells. There are some other organs that don't have a very strong or pronounced capacity for self-renewal, like the brain and the heart. And when we have injuries to those, we see a long-term or sustained injury because of the lack of stem cells and the lack of regenerative capacity. And another organ that fits in that example is, of course, the pancreas, which is when you lose your insulin-producing cells, they no longer reproduce themselves. But we can divide, generally, stem cells into two categories, at least for the sake of discussion, the stem cells of our own body, adult stem cells, which of course would include children's stem cells or newborn's stem cells, even fetal stem cells are categorized in this so-called adult stem cell category. And then there's another kind of stem cell, which we call pluripotent, or many cells with many abilities, which come from earlier stages of development, and they typically come from the embryos. In other words, these are the stem cells that made us as an individual. And that's the theme that I wanted to discuss with you today, which is the nature and capabilities and consequences of the properties that pluripotent stem cells have. Now, coming from early embryos, pluripotent stem cells share the properties of early embryos. And probably the most important property of an early embryo of a mammal, that is to say our class of organisms, is that they can make all the tissues of the entire conceptus, by which I mean both the fetus and the placenta, which is a separate organ that doesn't live after birth. It dies at birth and only leaves the fetus. But these cells are capable of making everything, these unspecialized cells. And I just want to put this in scale. This is an early human embryo, an image taken by my friend Yorgos Nikas when I was back in doing a mini sabbatical at Hammersmith about 15 years ago. This human embryo has 8 cells, as you can probably see, and it's resting on the point of a sewing pin, which has, as you can see, a diameter of about a tenth of a millimeter. That's the scale of the early human embryo within the first week after fertilization. So it's very tiny. These are embryos that are left over after in vitro fertilization treatment for infertility, and that's how we have access to them. In fact, very specifically because of the pioneering work of Robert Edwards, who worked here in Cambridge and discovered in vitro fertilization, really developed it in the late 70s. So if we expand this embryo a little bit, this is a different view. This is a scanning electron microscope view, but what you'll see next is a living human embryo. If we expand that a little bit, what you see is the individual cells in higher magnification being held here on a holder, microscopic view. This, of course, is magnified thousands of times because, again, this embryo is only a tenth of a millimeter across. And each one of these cells, it's been shown experimentally, has the capacity to produce all the tissues that come from the entire conceptus. Well, that's what we call totipotent or all-powerful. It's a different word than pluripotent. And the reason is that as the embryo progresses further, which is to say 2 days later, it forms a hollow cavity. And this hollow cavity allows you to see that some cells are now on the inside. We call them the inner cell mass. And others are on the outside where they form actually the cavity. So they actually contain the fluid in the cavity. And these cells become the placenta. All these outer cells go on to become the placenta. So the first major decision has been made, and the inner cells contribute to the fetus and some of the other membranes, such as the amnion. So these inner cells, now no longer can make placenta. They're not totipotent anymore, and we call them pluripotent. So these are the source of embryonic stem cells in all the studies that you've heard about so far. So the story is that the inner cell mass of the mouse blastocyst can be grown in culture and make cells that have the same quality of the inner cell mass itself, namely pluripotency. And that was first done also here at Cambridge in 1981 by Sir Martin Evans, now Sir Martin Evans, who won the Nobel Prize now just a few years ago for that contribution. And you can see these cells here. They're distinct from the more flattened out cells over here. We call those feeder cells. They are from mouse fetuses, not embryos. And they just provide some nutrients to the pluripotent cells here that we call embryonic stem cells, or ES cells. And I think you can see that they have a particular shape and feature that allows us to recognize them. They have a spot in the middle, a black spot. That's the nucleolus, a very prominent nucleolus. And a little halo around that, that's the nucleus. And they have a relatively large nucleus compared to the size of the cell. So a high nucleocytoplasmic ratio. In 1998, Jamie Thompson in the States succeeded, finally, after many attempts by him and others, to grow similar-looking cells from human embryos, from human blastocysts. And this shows a human blastocyst in the process of isolating its inner cell mass, which was then grown out into a colony of cells like this. Again, they have a very similar characteristic to the mouse, high nucleocytoplasmic ratio. And most importantly, they are also pluripotent. The conclusion that shows that they're pluripotent, the results that show they're pluripotent, are obtained in a different way than for the mouse embryos. Namely, in the mouse case, in the mouse embryonic stem cells, you can actually put them back into a blastocyst, the same stage, and put that blastocyst back into a uterus of a mother, an experiment that Anne McLaren showed could be done back in 1958. And such a blastocyst with embryonic stem cells inside of it will go on in complete development, and the offspring that results has contribution from the embryonic stem cell in all its body tissues. And that's how we first recognize the pluripotency. Obviously, you're not going to do that experiment with human ES cells. That would be unethical in a very high degree. So what is done in this case is that these putative pluripotent cells are put into an immunodeficient mouse. And there, they're able to develop into many different tissues, but not an organized fetus. They develop into a disorganized structure we call a teratoma. And if you slice that up, you can see many different tissues, and that's the basis of the conclusion that human ES cells are also pluripotent. The fact that they come from embryos confers upon human ES cells not only pluripotency, but also a host of ethical, legal, and social issues, implications, which have been discussed at great length in the press and in politics, especially in the States, where it's been more of a major political issue even than in Britain, where, in fact, it's been discussed at great length as well. So just to sort of recap this part of what I wanted to say, we now know that a lot more about the nature of pluripotent stem cells. They can be derived and are derived in the mouse by growing the inner cell mass. They can be derived by growing the inner cell mass in the human. But cells can also be grown from later stage mouse embryos after the mouse embryo has attached to the uterus. It's no longer a blastocyst, but I'll show you a picture of that in a moment. And we found in work that we now published a couple of years ago ourselves that the mouse pluripotent stem cells from the later stage actually are a better model, show greater similarity to the human embryonic stem cells than cells grown in the mouse from the blastocyst. In other words, human embryonic stem cells resemble a later stage of pluripotency than the mouse embryonic stem cell. Now, not only that, just now, 3 years ago, a Japanese researcher, Shinya Yamanaka, who just received, together with our own John Gurdon, the Lasker Award for Basic Medical Science. Shinya Yamanaka discovered that you can induce pluripotency in adult cells or newborn cells using information that he gained from studies of mouse embryonic stem cells. And I'll show you a little bit more about that. So there, in other words, we now know that there are several sources of pluripotent stem cells, and they all seem to have relatively similar qualities, except they fall into two categories: the mouse embryonic stem cell type and the human embryonic stem cell type, and they can be distinguished. So just to illustrate that point, we have an early embryo during the process of cleavage, has 8 cells or so. It develops into a blastocyst a couple of days later, whether that's in the human or the mouse. You can isolate the inner cells of that blastocyst and grow them. And if you do that in the mouse, you get mouse embryonic stem cells. If you do that in the human, of course, you get human embryonic stem cells. If you go to a later stage of mouse, this is about 3 days later, you can take these blue cells out, these so-called epiblast layer, and if you grow it in culture, you can get epiblast-derived stem cells, which are also pluripotent. And as I said, they have different properties than the mouse embryonic stem cells. And when we look at those properties in great detail, it turns out that they're similar to the human embryonic stem cells. So what we think happens in the human, in the process of deriving human embryonic stem cells, is that you get out the inner cell mass, and it grows in culture, but that it immediately progresses to this later stage, and that what ends up growing in the petri dish is the later stage type of cells, not the early stage. As yet, no one has been able to get human embryo-derived cells to self-renew at this stage. So there's something of a mystery still about why this difference between mouse and humans exists, that we can only grow humans at this stage, but we can grow mouse embryo-derived cells at either stage. And then finally, that if you go later in development, either at birth or even at adult stages, you can add certain factors that were identified in embryonic stem cell studies to cells that are actually at the adult stage, and you can grow induced pluripotent stem cells, as they're called, that have many shared properties, maybe all. So I'd like to now come back to this metaphor that I offered you about in my abstract, about the relationship between our origins and the origin of the universe, namely the Big Bang idea. And so if I may, at the risk of blurring the facts about astronomy a bit, which I'm not an expert on, liken what we're talking about to the Big Bang. Now, as many of you will know, having studied this more than I, the Big Bang is a theory about the origin of our universe that extends back about 14 billion years to an explosion which would have happened with a very intense and dramatic event at the beginning, the Big Bang itself, and that would have been followed by a period at which the universe, or the nascent universe, expanded enormously, even within a few seconds or less than a second, expanded enormously to give what we can now see, if we look very far back in time, the sort of limit of our view, which is a cosmic microwave radiation at about 3 degrees Kelvin, very, very low temperature. It's not zero, but it's very close to zero. And then following that, everything else has evolved. So if I may, with artistic license, say what I'm interested in is our individual Big Bang. That is to say, where did we come from as an individual? And what can stem cells tell us about that? Well, we know we come as mammals. We come from the uterus. We come from a prenatal period in which we grow. This illustrates only the first 55 or 60 days of human development. And you can see, since it's relatively to scale, that the embryo starts out at the stages we've been talking about, at the pre-implantation stage, as a tiny dot, as I said, a tenth of a millimeter in diameter, and then it grows as it attaches in the uterus, especially, it grows very fast, very quickly, into something that could be seen as something resembling ourselves, a fetus with a body. And this, you might think, because of the very rapid growth, is the so-called inflationary period, if you will, when expansion occurs dramatically. And then, of course, there's continuation of development as we are born and we grow as a child and grow into an adult. In fact, we continue to develop as adults. Eventually, we begin to age and continue to a more rapid change once again. But more for the most part, change through our middle life is relatively slow and hardly perceptible in a way. But if you will, take the analogy that prenatal development is this inflationary period when growth is very rapid. What happens before that? What happens at our Big Bang, at the very beginning of ourselves as individuals? So that I've tried to form as a kind of a concept of the origin of self. And so you might say, because it's often talked about, that that is fertilization. That is to say, that the moment of our beginning is fertilization, because that's when the two gametes come together to form a genetically unique individual. But as I said, I wasn't so much interested in the genetics. And for that matter, I don't really regard this event as being the seminal event, even though that fits the name, because the uniqueness of the sperm and the uniqueness of this huge structure here, the egg, the female contribution, is not determined at the moment of fertilization. Actually, they're already unique. These structures, believe it or not, the sperm and the egg, represent a different phase of our life cycle. They are their own organisms that live inside of us, that we claim, of course, is our own, but they are a separate phase of our life cycle that have a haploid genome, and they have their own identity. They have their own unique identity, and that's produced in meiosis, during meiosis, in our gonads, during the formation of the egg and the sperm. So I don't regard the union of the egg and the sperm as particularly important as an engine of uniqueness. I think that the engine of uniqueness is meiosis, and this is just adding two and two, one and one together to get a new individual. But that the individuality that they bring is created in meiosis at an earlier stage. So that I'm not going to give you fertilization as the origin of the self. I think rather that Lewis Wolpert had hit in his sights when he famously said, "It's not birth, marriage, or death, but gastrulation, which is the truly the most important time in your life." Now, gastrulation doesn't exactly fall off the tongue like stem cells, but let's consider for a moment what he said and whether it has some validity. What happens in gastrulation is that a sheet of cells, shown here in gray or in cross-section in purple or whatever that color is, a sheet of cells with one identity turns into a multi-layered structure with multiple identities. And not only that, it establishes the plan, the body plan of the future organism. So this upper layer is what I already showed you in blue in the diagram of the mouse embryo. That's what we call epiblast. It's a pluripotent cell type, that is, it's capable of forming multiple tissues, to be precise, of forming all the body tissues of the fetus. So these are the epiblast, these are the pluripotent stem cells of the embryo at this stage of gastrulation. And just to put that on a timeline, gastrulation in the human occurs at 2 weeks after fertilization, which is to say, just the moment, the day, that a woman would miss her period. So So that's the first possible moment that you would recognize that you're pregnant. And already the embryo has got that far. Well, this happens to be a chick embryo in the diagram, but still the human embryo is quite similar to it. So the pluripotent cells in gastrulation begin to migrate and leave this layer, some of them, and the orange ones are the ones that are leaving the layer, and they migrate down here in the middle, and they become so-called middle layer, mesoderm. And the ones that migrate a little further, become the inner layer, or endoderm, it's called, the yellow cells, and they're migrating out and joining this layer and becoming the inner layer, which becomes the gut. The middle layer becomes all the tissues of the muscle and the bone and the blood and the kidney and all the intermediate stuff. And the outer layer becomes our skin and our brain. Not only that, gastrulation is the time when our, as I said, our body plan is established. So the kind of body that we have is determined already at this point. Namely, we're bilaterally symmetrical. Your left side looks more or less like your right. And that stems from this exact event here where you have a left and right side. And you have a head and a tail. In other words, we're linear. And that's established in this dimension here. And you have a back and a front. And that's established at this time. So the body plan, the establishment of the body plan, traces back to gastrulation. Now, that clearly, not just because Lewis Wolpert said it, but because it's a fact of development, that clearly is a very important process then. The problem is, it's very difficult to study. Because as I said, this happens at 14 days. So between 14 and 15 days, it's pretty much, it's happening. It may continue for another couple days, but it happens more or less in a flash, as it were. Again, the metaphor of the Big Bang. And then these cells are locked in to their fates. So it's very difficult to study because you can't, first of all, you can't get these embryos. They're in the side of the wall of the uterus of the mother. You can't see them. Very few have ever been described in the scientific literature. And moreover, these events are happening in very small populations of cells, maybe as few as 20 cells. So it's very difficult to capture them in the act, as it were. So how do we study this? How can we study this process? So the answer, of course, is stem cells. It's to say, by looking at development in a dish. But we, of course, have to reassure ourselves that what we're looking at in the dish is relevant to what happens in the uterus, and in fact is a good model, as we say, of what goes on during our own Big Bang, during the origin of our body. So what I'd like to turn to now has some data in it, and I apologize if that goes too deeply, but at the end I'll come back to a summary, which hopefully will be completely accessible. So the question that we would frame when we ask it in a looking through a stem cell window is more, in a sense, kind of more linear or logic-based and not tissue-based, which is to say, if we flatten out the embryo and look at it as a set of decisions, what is it that controls the decision that pluripotent cells make, the epiblast or their equivalent in the petri dish, in deciding whether to go down the pathway toward endoderm to make up organs of the internal system, such as the pancreas or the liver or the lungs, which are gut-derived organs, or down the pathway toward mesoderm, which makes up the heart and the kidney and parts of other organs, as I said, or to make the outer layer, to make neurons and skin. So what is it that controls those decisions? First of all, what is it that controls the decision to stay pluripotent or not? So I'm really going to talk just about two issues that emerge from some of our own recent work, which is how human embryonic stem cells stay pluripotent through the role of a protein called activin. It's probably it's probably not the factor that acts in the embryo, but it's a stand-in for something that does act in the embryo that's called nodal, but since we use activin, I'll talk about it as activin. And another protein called FGF, which I won't discuss much because we've left it in the cultures. And the role of activin, in fact, the absence of activin, in the decision to make neuroectoderm. As I say, we've left FGF in the cultures. So I'll pretty much limit what I have to say to the role of that. Now, before I go on, I think it's important to introduce a player in the process, which is called Nanog, which it comes from the word Tir Nanog, the land of the ever young. And it was discovered by my current colleague, Austin Smith, and his co-workers several years ago. It's expressed in cells in the inner cell mass of a blastocyst, and it's expressed in pluripotent cells thereafter. And it's what we call a marker of pluripotency. That is to say, it's expressed during pluripotency in pluripotent cells, and it's lost when cells specialize, when they differentiate. There are other markers too, but I'll talk more about Nanog. But Nanog makes part of a circuit, what we would like to think of as more or less like an electrical circuit in the cells, where genes regulate themselves and each other through interactions in the genetic regulatory material. And Nanog, as shown by this arrow here, regulates itself. Actually, that is shown here by this arrow. It leads to the production of Nanog protein through expression of the Nanog gene. Another marker that's part of this, what we call a core transcription circuit, core circuit, is called SOX2. And a third one is called OCT4. Actually, OCT4 was the first to be discovered, and Nanog the last. And together, these three make up this circuit that drives, it's a feed-forward circuit, that is to say, it drives its own continued expression. And it's been shown by blocking expression of individual genes that this circuit is essential for pluripotency. So it's not only a marker, these genes are not only markers of pluripotency, but they're also makers of pluripotency, or masters of pluripotency. So I just wanted to tell you about them. And then to tell you that what controls the expression of those genes is activin. And this is a result of multiple studies in our own group and also elsewhere in the world that have shown now conclusively that activin is an essential component of the regulatory machinery controlling this core transcription circuit. And you can see the evidence for that here. These are cells, these are pictures of cells that were grown in activin plus FGF, as I said earlier, fibroblast growth factor. Each row is a different type of human embryonic stem cell. Here, the first two are ones that were made by Jamie Thompson in Wisconsin, back, published in 98, and given to us as a collegial gift. HSF6 is a cell that we made in San Francisco back in 2001. When I was there. And what you see here is pictures of the nuclei of these cells, and every single nucleus is stained either with OCT4, with SOX2, I haven't shown Nanog, or with some surface markers. We call this one TRA-160. It's named after the Battle of Trafalgar by Peter Andrews, who made the antibody up in Sheffield, SSEA4 and alkaline phosphatase. And I think you can see that every single cell is stained with these markers, that is to say, they're all pluripotent, and they're maintained in pluripotency in a chemically defined medium with activin. If you take out the activin, even if you have FGF, the cells differentiate. They just grow better with FGF too. So we know on that basis that activin is essential for pluripotency in human ES cells, and in the context of the chemically defined medium that we use, it's sufficient. Now, since I'm talking extensively about activin, I should tell you something about how it works. It's a protein. It's a growth, what's in this category of proteins called growth factors. That is, they're proteins that act on the surface of cells to stimulate or trigger events in the cell internally. And the way they act is they act through receptors in kind of lock and key way, so that the receptor changes, and actually what happens is that these so-called type 1 and type 2 receptors connect in the cell, and that triggers a signal that goes down the pathway of these molecules. SMAD is intermediate effector of activin signaling. The SMAD then, this blue meant to refer to the cytoplasm, the SMAD 2-3 connects with another SMAD called 4. They go into the nucleus where they hook up with other factors and regulate the expression of genes. That's how growth factors act. They act through transcription factors, as these intermediates are called, that regulate the transcription or expression of other genes. So we looked in human embryonic stem cells, given that we were seeing effects of activin, and as a circumstantial evidence that, that activin is active, you actually see the activity of SMAD2 and SMAD3 in the nucleus. That is to say, they're in the nucleus when they're active, and that's where they belong if they're acting to support pluripotency. And this is just to show you OCT4 and the overlap of SMADs. So they're all in the nucleus where they belong if they're active. Now, not only are they active, but as I said to you, they are specifically activating NANOG. And the reason we know that is that we can look, because, as I say, we have this system of stem cells, we can look at millions of cells that are doing more or less the same thing, unlike the embryo where maybe you'd only have 10 or 20 or 50 cells. We can grow up to 10 million cells in a petri dish, in a set of petri dishes, and start to look at things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to see because of this enormous amplification capacity that you have in the stem cells. And what we're looking at here is different regions along the NANOG gene. This is it shown in lower power here. Here's the beginning of the NANOG gene, where the NANOG protein begins. And then this is the regulatory part of the NANOG gene. And what you can see is that that regulatory part binds the NANOG protein. In this technique, it's called chromatin immunoprecipitation. That part of it binds the NANOG itself, it binds SOX2, it binds OCT4, and that's the core transcriptional circuit. That's why we know that exists. But it also binds SMAD2-3, and that's right here. And this is just showing that in greater detail. So here's region F, which is the most intense binding. And by looking at that capacity for binding and looking at the effects of altering the NANOG gene so it doesn't have the capacity to bind, you can show, as I said, that SMAD2-3 controls the expression of NANOG. Now, I want to now turn to the role of activin signaling in neural differentiation, but essentially to say that activin controls or blocks neural differentiation through the expression of NANOG. So that is a way of saying that if you inhibit activin signaling, which you can do with a chemical inhibitor, you induce the differentiation of neural cells. So these cells have all been inhibited treated with an inhibitor of activin signaling, and they begin to express neural specific marker genes like Nestin, neural cell adhesion molecule, and these others. And that is all mediated by NANOG, which silences itself when you don't have activin nodal signaling. Now, you can also knock out the function of NANOG more specifically, not by removing the activin, but by specifically inhibiting NANOG. And if you do that, you also, again, see the upregulation of genes involved in neural differentiation, one called PAC6 and one called SOX1. So we know from more extensive experiments of this sort that NANOG is directly involved in blocking neural differentiation, and it does so because it is itself in turn driven by activin. So just to sum up that aspect of the work, I I would remind you that Activin, Axsusmads 2 and 3, that binds to the NANOG gene and its regulatory part and promotes the activity of NANOG. NANOG, in turn, is necessary to inhibit neural ectoderm differentiation. So if you inhibit activin signaling, it leads to the loss of NANOG, and that leads to the differentiation of neural cell types. So you could, of course, ask, and you can go on asking these questions as we do, how does NANOG act? And that's the last data I'll show you, namely that NANOG, we discovered, acts through another protein called SMAD interacting protein 1, CYP1, which itself is a promoter of neural differentiation. This is an interesting gene because it's known in the human that mutations in this gene lead to a syndrome called Moet-Wilson syndrome, which involves defects in the development of neural tissues, particularly tissues of nerves that act throughout the body. And so if we look at cells that overexpress CYP1, as these cells here, you can see that they dramatically accelerate the development of neural tissues, neural neurites, really, nerve cells, in the cultures, even as early as 7 days of culture in these nerve-inducing conditions, as compared to the controls, which are much slower to develop nerves. These are just two different cultures of CYP1 overexpressing cells. So it's through this process that we can then systematically begin to chip away at the ignorance about how early cell types develop from pluripotent cells. And as I say, CYP1 we found is necessary for human embryonic stem cell development to neuroectoderm by accelerating that pathway. It also, in work that I haven't shown you, acts to block the alternate pathway, which is mesoderm and endoderm. So if we look now, and this is a summary, if we look at the role of these factors, the core transcription network and CYP1, what we see is that SOX2, OCT4, and NANOG act together to reinforce each other's expression, and together those drive pluripotency. If we introduce CYP1 into this picture, what we know about CYP1 is that it promotes neural ectoderm differentiation and blocks, that's what this square arrow means, blocks development of mesoderm and endoderm. Now, the way this is held in check, this blocking effect, is that ordinarily SMAD 2 and 3 block CYP1 or keep it at a low level, and as does NANOG, as does OCT4. So the pluripotency promoting effects prevent the CYP1 neuroectoderm promoting effects. But the other player in the core transcription network, SOX2, actually promotes CYP1. So what happens when differentiation occurs, and this is actually known, the role of activin in this process is also known to be true in mouse embryos, although in less detail. What happens if you block activin nodal signaling, that's what we do typically with an inhibitor, what happens is that NANOG goes away, OCT4 goes away, and pluripotency ceases. The cells differentiate, and owing to the cessation of inhibition of CYP1, the residual SOX2 drives the increase in CYP1, and that then promotes neuroectoderm differentiation and blocks mesendoderm, so you get the decision between mesoderm and endoderm, largely being made by CYP1, which is, as I said, held in check by NANOG in pluripotent cells. So this is to illustrate, then, our way of proceeding to gain insights that wouldn't be otherwise achievable in embryos, and particularly wouldn't be achievable at all in human embryos, but we can gain them through studies on embryonic stem cells. So to sum up, then, what I wanted to say about the scientific part, the pluripotency of human embryonic stem cells is maintained by activin, and which we think is acting through the pathway that would be ordinarily achieved by nodal in the embryo. It blocks neuroectoderm differentiation. It also blocks mesendoderm in other studies that I haven't told you about. In the absence of NANOG, which is driven by active and nodal signaling, then CYP1 expression increases, and that drives neural differentiation. And that's essentially opens a window of insight that we can then look more generally and see how it applies. And the first thing that we see is that that insight also applies to the epiblast stem cells that we made from mouse, as I told you, and in studies that we've just published, we've shown that it equally well applies to human-induced pluripotent stem cells. In other words, it's a broad insight that applies to all cells at this later stage of pluripotency that reflects the stage of gastrulation or just before gastrulation in mammalian embryos. So now if I could extend this to a more general level and answer the question that I posed at the beginning, which is what can stem cells tell us about ourselves? This is what I would say, that the key embryonic events that happen in the second and third week after fertilization, when the embryo is embedded in the uterus, can't be studied in the embryo, certainly not in the human embryo. And so we're handicapped about getting insights into our own development, our development of our own species. We actually know more about the mouse and the sea urchin than we know about ourselves during that period. And that these cell fate decisions occur during brief periods and in small groups of cells, and so they're very difficult to study in embryos in any case. And by growing stem cells in the petri dish, we acquire the ability to gain insights, actually very rapidly, about events in our early development. And I believe that this can be extended onwards to later developmental events so that we will progressively begin to understand how those decisions are made between cell types that don't exist before gastrulation, that come into being in gastrulation, and actually define the structure and the features of our body as an individual for the first time in our life at the time of gastrulation. So I wouldn't want to leave without acknowledging two things. One is that this work does have an ethical dimension. So I hope there'll be some time to discuss that. But in any case, I would just say that the ethical dimension is not limited to the source of cells, which, of course, is controversial when those sorts of cells are spare in vitro fertilization embryos. It's less controversial if they're adult cells, but I think there's still an issue, an ethical issue, about informed consent. There are ethical issues in the potential risks to patients if we proceed with transplantation studies. I think that it's very difficult to guarantee that such studies involving transplantation of cells are safe and effective, and those so that early patients will take risks. And I think there are also issues about affordability or access to these technologies, and that we should be very attentive to the distributive justice issue. That is to say, will people in underdeveloped countries have access to these technologies? Will we? Or are they just going to be available to the very few, very wealthy, super wealthy, who can afford customized therapies? And I don't think we should let that happen. And then I would finally like to acknowledge people in our team, particularly Gabriel Bronze, who derived the epiblast stem cells, Jenzi Chung, who did all the studies on CYP1 that I mentioned, and Ludovic Valier, who was formerly a postdoctoral fellow with us and now has his own group in the Laboratory for Regenerative Medicine, who contributed the studies on NANOG. And if you'd like to follow our work, I would certainly invite you to do that. You can see across the Cambridge stem cell landscape by looking at www.stemcells.cam.ac.uk.